KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Saratoga.
Presidio.
San Francisco, California, Excelsior District, District 11.
Coming up, what to do in case of an earthquake.
We want everyone to be self-sufficient and able to help their neighbors who are in trouble.
Behind the scenes with community emergency response trainers. Then we'll hear the backstory of the Pulitzer Prize-winning work on the Ghost Ship fire.
In a situation like this where you don't know what's happening until you get out there and start looking at it, it's really hard to know exactly what to do.
Insight from the East Bay Times. And we'll learn how Bay Bridge officials are trying to lure nesting birds back.
There are mirrors. There is, in fact, a sound system that gives off cormorant calls.
Stay tuned for the Bay Area's sound system. Cross Currents is next. We're just a few days away from an historic anniversary. San Francisco's great earthquake happened April 18th, 1906. We all know we're supposed to prepare for the next big one, but how many of us really have a plan? We went to downtown Oakland and took a little survey.
Try to not have too much loose crap around, you know, or like things that'll topple over.
I'm prepared at home with water.
I just take it one day at a time and don't worry about it.
No, I haven't prepared.
I'll probably be the first to die.
Those were the voices of Ann Lackey, Rachel Berkowitz, J. Maurice Butler, Richard Green, and Jane Shao. Lately, KALW's Eli Wirtschafter has been thinking about how to improve his own earthquake plan.
I recently moved to a new neighborhood in Berkeley, and on a sunny afternoon shortly after moving, I saw something I had never witnessed before. A troop of my neighbors with hard hats and bright yellow vests doing an emergency drill out on the sidewalk.
The fire department isn't going to be able to show up everywhere, you know, and so we're going to be on our own for a while.
That's my neighbor, Steve Greenberg. He and his wife keep a stash of emergency supplies for the whole neighborhood. The exercise was happening in their driveway, three doors down from me. I missed most of the drill, so I caught up with him later to find out what the plan was for our neighborhood.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Thanks so much for letting me check this out.
Sure.
We head to the backyard, and he shows me this big gray plastic shed. Inside are all the emergency supplies. After a serious earthquake, my neighbors and I are supposed to gather here.
We've volunteered on a temporary basis to put it back here, and it's been here ever since.
In the city of Berkeley, any neighborhood can apply for one of these caches. They're worth $3,000 or $4,000, and the city will pay for it if the neighborhood can meet certain standards.
The neighborhood was sufficiently organized and trained to qualify for cash, and so that's how we got it.
The city says this program is the first of its kind. To date, they've delivered over 100 of these caches to different neighborhoods. Steve unlocks the shed.
So there's no food or water in here, but there's other supplies like for search and rescue and firefighting, and there's a generator and some lights. And
inside are some things you'd expect, like a big first aid kit. But there are also things that were totally unfamiliar, at least to me.
How does it fit on you? Is it like, is it sling over your front?
It's a backpack.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Can you show me?
Yeah.
It's a backpack full of water with a little metal hose sticking out. It's for putting out fires.
It's heavy because it's got, like I said, 5 gallons of water in it.
There's supposed to be water coming out of the pipe.
This thing might be in need of cleaning. Well, it's not. There you go, see? Underscoring the need for regular maintenance.
Steve was around for the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. He went down and volunteered at a Red Cross shelter where displaced people were camping out. It had an impact on him.
Any such experience always, you know, makes you think about, well, what worked, what didn't work, you know, how could I be personally better prepared? How could I better help other people?
People like me, with absolutely no earthquake plan.
So let's say I'm trapped in my basement two houses down.
Hopefully you would be able to, you know, yell out, and then we would organize a team and use our search and rescue equipment.
But how would all those other neighbors know what to do? It kind of depends on more of them taking emergency preparedness classes, like Steve has done.
If you don't know what you're doing, it could be more dangerous than helpful.
I wanted to be helpful, not dangerous. So I went to a free training in my neighborhood, put on by the city of Berkeley. It's called a CERT class. CERT stands for Community Emergency Response Team. I found out that the CERT instructors know Steve pretty well.
He is one of the sweetest, most wonderful, most organized, virtually brilliant, Einstein-like person I've ever met in my life. I idolize him, man.
That's Bill Springer. He's another guy who loves being prepared.
I've got one neighbor who, when he sees me, he walks by and says, well, have a disastrous day.
For most of us, disaster preparedness doesn't sound so fun. That's why we put it off and put it off. But at the training with me today are 14 Berkeley citizens who have resisted that urge. People like Maggie Heffernan, who sounds like she'd prefer to spend a Saturday morning anywhere else.
I don't feel like doing this, but I'm doing it. In case we have a major disaster, I don't want to be totally in the dark.
In today's class, we're learning how to operate a command post, like what Steve's backyard would become after a disaster. And the whole point, says Bill Springer, is to be organized.
Having people go around willy-nilly it's unsafe, for one thing. It's horribly unsafe.
We break up into groups. Each response team gathers around a table with a map of a made-up neighborhood. And it's Berkeley, so the streets have names like Yogurt Way and Veggie Court. Another teacher, Sean Connors, gives us the situation.
There has been a strong earthquake centered in San Pablo Bay. You are frightened and trying to calm yourself down. You assume first responders are overwhelmed and your neighborhood will be on its own for the foreseeable future.
Everyone at the table picks a role.
I'd like to try scribe. The last time I was operations, I lost people in the field.
Well, I'll lose the people today. It's just an exercise.
We're not supposed to be terrified.
But it's hard to keep cool, because inside the scenario, Berkeley is in chaos. An instructor calls in via walkie-talie.
ITP-6, I have a report of a hysterical woman yelling about her son, something about bricks falling and not talking. The address here is 1202 Veggie Court. Over.
I think the danger is that somebody is under those bricks. That's why if she's so upset, her son might be under those bricks. This is an more urgent situation.
The team dispatches a rescue party.
Send two people out to get her.
To Yogurt Way and Cappuccino.
Here.
ITA-4, this is ITP-1, go ahead.
They get bombarded with reports like this for about an hour. They make quick decisions, and this is crucial, they keep good records.
This is the end of the exercise. Now you're gonna have a couple of minutes to prepare an incident report for the fire department.
The whole thing was intense, but we all survived. Here's Margaret Goyette.
Feel more prepared, but the more prepared you feel, the more you realize you've got a lot more work to go.
It's true. You never know how bad an earthquake is going to be.
The city is not prepared unless everyone in the city is prepared.
That's instructor Bill Springer again.
If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Well, we don't want anybody to be a problem or have a problem. We want everyone to be self-sufficient and able to help their neighbors who are in trouble.
I'd been counting on my neighbor Steve to save me, but maybe I need to get a little more proactive. In Berkeley, I'm Eli Wirtschafter for Cross Currents.
We've got links to emergency preparedness classes in cities all around the Bay. Go to our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We'll head now to Columbia University in New York. On Monday, a bespectacled man named Mike Pride walked to a podium ready to make a big announcement.
Just making sure I have the right envelope. The Pulitzer Prize for breaking news reporting goes to the staff of the East Bay Times.
The Pulitzer Prize was awarded for, quote, relentless coverage of the ghost ship fire and for reporting after the tragedy that exposed the city's failure to take actions that might have prevented it. Neil Chase is executive director of the Bay Area News Group, which oversees the East Bay Times. KALW's Ben Trefney reached him in his office to talk about what it took to win journalism's top honor.
When the ghost ship fire erupted, how did East Bay Times and the Bay Area News Group handle that breaking news?
Well, you know, this story started a little before 4 o'clock in the morning. Like so many stories in Oakland have over the past 40-plus years, Harry Harris, who is a crime and breaking news reporter in Oakland and has been for decades, got a call from someone, as he often does, saying, hey, this is a big story, you need to know about it. And so he was the first one to hear about it. He raised the alarm, got some other people going. And you know, by daybreak, we had a handful of people already working the story and more people coming in all morning.
And to you, what do you think made your ghost ship coverage stand out the most?
You know, the competitions, these journalism competitions are very competitive, and we're competing against some of the best news organizations in the country. And so it's an honor to be even nominated, much less to win. As we look back at the judging on these contests, what we're seeing is a couple things that kept coming up. One is how quickly we got the initial story out there to let people know what was going on. Another is how much we updated it through the day and through the days after the fire constantly. And then there are, I think, two more pieces that really stood out. One is the fact that we immediately, within a couple hours of finding out about the fire, we launched the investigative reporting, the digging into building permits and inspection records and what the fire department had done, even on a Saturday, trying to get as much of that information as we could, as quickly as we could, to really understand what the story was behind this. And then at the end of the week, a week later, we did a long form story that really walked people through everything that happened step by step through the entire time leading up to the fire itself, and the aftermath, so that a week later you could really give people as much as we know about the full context and the full story of what happened through that tragedy. And that's what I think stood out to some of the judges in these contests.
And now that you've won the Pulitzer for this coverage, looking back, what do you think you could have done better?
In a situation like this, where you don't know what's happening until you get out there and start looking at it, it's really hard to know exactly what to do, right? You always wish you were a little better organized. You wish you had all the right people in the right places at the right time. If we had known how long it was going to go on, we might have tried to figure out a better way to support the reporters that were out there, especially as it got cold during the week, you know, standing outside there at the fire scene. But overall, I'm real proud of what this team did. Everybody got out there and did what they know how to do, what they've been trained to do. It's an instinct you build up pretty quickly in journalism. And so there's not a lot to regret about this story, except, of course, the key fact that we shouldn't have won the Pulitzer Prize and we shouldn't have had to do this story, because these people should not have died in that fire. You know, this is our community. The people who are covering this story live in the Bay Area. Many of them live in Oakland. A lot of people covering the story either knew somebody who died in the fire or knew somebody who knew someone. And it's a very personal story. As much as you want to try to be objective, there's nothing objective about 36 young people dying in a tragic fire. It's a horrible story, and I'm very proud of the people who covered it so well under tough circumstances, but this is not the way you want to win journalism awards.
And I saw that the organization donated the prize money to victims' causes.
Yeah, we've won a couple awards for the ghost ship coverage now, and this is the second one that came with a cash award. And, you know, usually in a journalism contest, if a story is done by a particular person, somebody wins for a great investigative report or great editorial writing or something like that. If there's a cash award, it would go to the person who did the work. When it's a team award like this, you might say, oh, let's use the money for something internal, let's use the money for the staff, let's use the money to set up a scholarship for journalism somewhere, or something like that. In this case, we took a very short amount of time to decide that the one and only right thing to do is to have this money go to the funds that are supporting the victims' families. There's so much damage that can't be fixed with money, but if this can help a little bit, we want the money to go there, and the organizations that provide the prize money are very much in favor of that, and we're happy to hear us do that.
That's Neil Chase. He's executive editor of Bay Area News Group. So your organization, like many news organizations, has had to make several cuts in recent years, and clearly the result of that for you has been earning a Pulitzer Prize. that probably isn't the case for everybody. But I'm wondering, how has Bay Area News Group changed, and why have changes been made necessary?
Yeah, this is a time of tremendous change in the news business, right? The U.S. newspaper industry as a whole has lost a vast amount. 80% of its revenue has gone away in the past 17 years since the peak in the year 2000. And so we're in a different business. It has changed a lot. There was a time when there were more different newspapers serving the Bay Area. And the East Bay Times last week had its first birthday. Now, the East Bay Times is comprised of the Oakland Tribune and the Contra Costa Times and several other papers from Alameda and Contra Costa counties, which have decades of history behind them. And certainly the journalists who've been working at those places for a long time are still part of our team. So we do have fewer people in the news organization than we used to. We have to be more creative about how we cover things, and we are doing more work, right? We're putting out a newspaper as well as publishing online and through social channels and lots of other methods. And so, you know, we don't have enough people to do the breadth of coverage we might have done 17 years ago, but we have plenty of people to cover a story like this that is the kind of thing that everybody gets involved with. So this wasn't a story for the Metro reporters or the City Desk reporters. Or one newsroom. This was a story covered by Bay Area News Group reporters from all over the Bay Area, from our Oakland and Walnut Creek and Pleasanton and San Jose newsrooms and others. Everybody pitched in. And as small as we are now compared to the size we used to be, that's not an excuse. That's not a reason to do lower quality coverage. There are much smaller news organizations doing fantastic jobs every day in the Bay Area. Covering stories very well, winning awards themselves, breaking news. We have a lot of good people here and a lot of professional people who are very passionate about what they do. And when you need to cover that big story and throw everybody at it, that's what we can do, and that's what we need to do to make sure people still get the coverage they need and the journalism that a society and a community demand.
Neil Chase is executive editor of Bay Area News Group. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. Find links to the Pulitzer Prize-winning work at KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The last of the old Bay Bridge came down a few weeks ago. That means the end of a habitat for the double-crested cormorants that nested there. At their height in 2007, more than 1,200 nests were counted in the underbelly of the Bay Bridge. Now that their home has been deconstructed, Caltrans is trying to entice the birds to relocate to the new stainless steel bridge, aka the Corm Condos. Lisa Masitsis was there when the bridge still stood and the deconstruction was just getting underway. Let's listen back to the ecosystem of sounds that once spanned the bay.
When I asked to get on the Old Bay Bridge, or as I called it, the Ghost Bridge, I figured the answer would be no. It's a demolition site. Parts of the bridge are totally missing, like an open-mouthed grin missing half its teeth. So when Caltrans said they'd put me on a boat and float me beneath the old bridge, I was so excited. And here's something I learned firsthand about the Ghost Bridge. It's loud.
It's actually music to my ears.
That's Leah Robinson Leach. She's the spokesperson for the Bay Bridge.
I'm so accustomed to it, though. I don't even hear it. Those are natural sounds to me.
Sounds like
blowtorches.
the tall tower crane, the wonderful noise of the bay beneath, and the cars that are passing on the New Bay Bridge right next to it.
Now, I wasn't allowed to get on the actual bridge. I had to stick to my boat beneath the bridge. Most of the tape I got was muffled by the sounds of a running motor and the rushing water, like this. So Robinson Leach set me up with Robert Eikenberry. He's the safety director on phase one of the bridge's demolition. He also happens to be a documentary filmmaker, a very thorough, thoughtful documentary filmmaker with his own audio recorder.
This is calling the construction elevator. These sounds are a crane and the man lift backup alarms. Sound of the crane extending its boom.
Eikenberry is stationed at the Admiral's House on Yerba Buena Island. It's a beautiful Victorian that overlooks the water, the bridges, and Oakland. When I went to pick up the recordings he made for me, we stood on the porch and gazed out at the bay. I asked if he'd managed to get any tape of the birds, and he laughed and told me, "They're pretty hard to nail down." Of course, I'm talking about the cormorants. Hundreds of shiny jet-black birds with long, pale beaks and graceful, flared-out wings. They nest in the underbelly of the old bridge. Caltrans wants to move them before deconstruction gets too severe, before the birds' lives are endangered.
It's like the birds are the only ones who haven't gotten the message yet that there's a new bridge.
It's like we can tell them, we can let them know this is what you're supposed to do, but they seem quite comfortable. And they love the old bridge. So
how to get the birds to love the new bridge?
Decoys. They look to the naked eye. To be cormorants, they look like the actual thing, and they are in fact decoys to assist in attracting the birds.
In other words, tons and tons of fake birds glued all over the base of the new bridge. But that's not all.
There are mirrors. There is, in fact, a sound system that gives off cormorant calls.
That's right, a giant sound system beneath the new bridge, designed to lure the birds over with sounds of their own mating calls. And I have to point out how Northern California this is. Usually, decoys are used by hunters to trap animals before killing them for their meat or fur. Here in the Bay Area, on the border between Oakland and San Francisco, we're using decoys to preserve life. And for the next few years, while we're breaking that old bridge up, piece by piece, and erasing it from the physical world, well, it's really nice to know that there's some life down there. Under the Old Bay Bridge, I'm Lena Mesitsis for Cross Currents.
That story first aired in 2014. The cormorants haven't been won over to the new bridge yet. The corm condos remain empty, but researchers say they're a sturdy, adaptive species. And that's all for the show today. The Cross Currents team includes Josiah Louise Alderete, Nina Gensler-Debs, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. And a big shout out to Ted Muldoon. He started out a few years ago as a summer volunteer here in our news department. Then he joined our audio academy. His sound engineering skills have enhanced many KALW shows, Cross Currents, Sights and Sounds, FSFSF, Kamau Right Now, and 99% Invisible. Well, today is his last day with us as he's off to work with the Washington Post. We're proud of you, Ted, and we'll miss you. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Chuck Prophet.
NPR says his latest album, quote, feels like riding shotgun down some mythic highway with a rock true believer. If that sounds interesting, you can hear Chuck Prophet live at Great American Music Hall in his hometown of San Francisco. That's this Saturday night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
My life is an experiment that doesn't prove a thing. I wake up every morning wondering what the day will bring. Then I throw open the windows, I fill up both my lungs, and I shout, look out all you losers, here I come. So when